And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and accessible. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak, and we have an action-packed show for you this morning. We're going to start out with an expanded Today's Cool Story on wild hops that grow in Park City and how Wasatch Brew Pub picked them and brewed 14 delicious barrels of beer. After that, our first guest, Daniel Goldman, Georgia Institute of Technology, is going to talk to us about how rattlesnakes can teach robots how to move and navigate up sand dunes and steep slopes.
And good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Ruth DeFries, who has written the book, The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Our species long lived on the edge of starvation, but now we produce enough food for all 7 billion of us. The Big Ratchet is the story of how it happened, of the ratchets, the technologies, and the innovations, both big and small, that propelled our species from hunters and gatherers on the savannas of Africa to shoppers in the aisles of the supermarket.
And finally, we'll speak with Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. We are closing in on the second year anniversary of this 1.8 million square foot monster that hammered the Caribbean and just blasted the East Coast. It was the largest storm anyone had ever seen. It charged across open ocean, picked up strength with every step, baffled everybody, meteorologists, scientists, officials, emergency managers, even the traditional maritime wisdom of sailors and seamen. We look forward to our conversation with Catherine.
Yes, a big day. Okay, so, John, we always talk about going on field trips. You know, there's that electric car charging track being built at Utah State University. We want to go there. We want to go visit the James Webb Space Telescope under construction in Magna. We want to go to the Mars Simulation Lab down in southern Utah somewhere. But we haven't quite made it out of town yet, have we?
Well, we got to get out of town, but we did go on a field trip last week. We made it out of the studios of KPCW on a science exploration. We went all the way. Are you ready? We went all the way to the top of Main Street to the Wasatch Brew Pub.
It took us, what, like 3 minutes to get there on foot?
Yeah, it did.
So, okay, so you've probably heard about the Wild Hops Hikes with Summit Lands Conservancy. So all summer long, well, actually, it began last year, they identified where wild hops were growing in Old Town. It's part of our mining history, so it goes. So this year, they hiked all summer long, they looked and to see when the hops were ready to be picked, and on August 27th, they harvested the hops. They were worried about rain and the frost, which actually destroyed the hops last year. And out of that, in a great little partnership with Wasatch Beers, they came up with a wild hop beer.
And of course, it's called Clothing Hoptional.
Of course. Well, Justin Kingsford is the head brewer, the brewmaster at the Wasatch Brew Pub on Main Street. We spoke with him about how he took wild hops gathered from around Old Town and this hearty group of volunteers who like to hike in search of wild hops to make beer, of course. Sounds like a good endeavor, doesn't it, JW?
It certainly does, and it certainly also did not hold us back from sampling it at 10 a.m. last Friday morning.
That's right. So here's our conversation about science, cool science, right here in town.
And Justin is into this stuff because he's a scientist. He tells us all about it, the science of brewing beer with wild hops. But it's also about fermentation and why you need hops in general.
Position is, the head brewer, brewmaster, overseeing the operations and the production of the beer up here.
How many times have you brewed a beer with wild hops? Is this completely out of the realm of normal, everyday operations?
Yes, this is. This is actually the first time I've brewed a beer with wild hops.
Can you tell us the history of the wild hops and where they came from?
They believe that the wild hops were planted up here by the German immigrant miners that were up here in the late 19th century, early 1900s. So I believe they believe they're a Hauertau, Mittelfrüh, or German descent hops. We don't know that quite right now, but I'm actually going to be pulling a clippings from the hops to send up to Hopsteiner, and they're going to run a DNA analysis on the hops to figure out the possible lineage of the hops.
And you ought to hear Justin talk about science, which he's about to do, because it's in his, it's in his genes, it's in his DNA, just like it's in the wild hops.
My background is I have a bachelor's in microbiology and chemistry.
How does your science background tie into what you do here? Like, what's the most fascinating thing from a science-y perspective that you do?
To make beer, we use yeast. We use a living organism. And in order to create that beer, we got to take care of our yeast. And yeast, without yeast, yeast makes the beer. So
yeah.
Yeast takes and ferments our sugars and to create all the different flavors that you get in beer. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So without the yeast, I guess there's no beer. And so what really got me into brewing was the whole biochemistry and physiology of fermentation and how the yeast takes the sugars and amino acids present in the wort to create all the different, the alcohol and all the different flavor compounds. But there's also the hops too, the chemistry of the hops. The hops have alpha acids and essential oils that create those floral and citrusy and grassy notes. And so there's a whole bunch of chemistry involved in that too.
Is this a possible scenario where German immigrant miners came in and they planted hops so that they could brew their own beer, and then we shut down mining operations and become a ski town, and people have their homes, let's say in Old Town, Park City, and they have what they think might be weeds or something growing in their lawn. They don't even know that they have hops. Is that possible?
Yeah, that could be very well possible. Granted, I wasn't around at that time that they were planted, so, but I couldn't tell you exactly how the hops got planted, but that's what they believe to think.
Yeah, so say I'm a miner and I'm a big time beer drinker and I bring my hops, what would you call them, you know, your start from to plant a hop?
It's called a hop rhizome, actually, and it's the
hop
root.
Hop rhizome, there we go.
And so you could actually take cuts of hops from the roots and you can transplant them. And that's how you kind of, you can buy commercially grown hops, actually, and plant them in your backyard.
Right.
Like different varieties. Certain proprietaries you can't because the hop farms have been working and breeding and selecting for those. But other varieties like Cascade and ones that have been around for decades, you can get a hop cutting and plant it in your backyard and grow your own hops.
Is that right? So now, if those miners hadn't had hops, but they love to brew beer, where would they have been without these wild hops that are now growing around the hills in Park City?
Well, they would have had to source their hops from somewhere else, but if you can grow your own hops, and especially in an area, a mining town, it's a lot easier to brew if you have your own hops.
Okay, so there is no beer that's without hops. This just shows how little I know about the hops. I mean, I know there are hoppy beers and not so hoppy beers. They used to
brew beer without hops back before the 15th century. But then once hops came along, hops became a dominant flavor addition to the beer. Not only just because of the flavor the hops add, but there's also antimicrobial properties that help keep the store the beer and improve the shelf life of the beer, because the isoalpha acids and the oils present in the hops help to reduce microbial growth in the beer. And so it's kind of a preserving agent. And so once they figured out they got the hops, hops have basically gone forward as one of the main components in beer.
I have to believe that wild hops, or brewing beer with wild hops, is very unique because hop production today by the big organizations has probably gone the way of corn and wheat genetically modified. Is that going on with the hops as well?
You know, they're not genetically modifying hops. I mean, they're breeding and selecting for them, but it's nothing like actually laboratory engineered GMO of hops. Now, I guess they've been, but with anything, with crops and as humans, we've been artificially selecting with our cultivation and our farming techniques for certain strains of hops, and that mm-hmm. does go on. And with the modern hops, they're breeding these hops for alpha, like essential oils, their flavor compounds, their alpha acid levels, and their disease resistance too, because the farmers don't want to have a crop that won't stand up to disease, because when it comes harvest time, if the disease kills the hops, then they lose their money. So
could you tell us about the yield of these wild hops and how that translates to how much beer you're able to make?
You know what, I couldn't tell you the acreage of pounds per acreage of what the hops would yield, but they, I mean, with wild hops, your cone size isn't as large as regular cultivated hops. Your pounds per acreage is drastically lower. I mean, because they are wildly grown, they're not in a farming environment.
So it ends up that they gathered 42 pounds of hops, and that translates to 14 barrels of clothing, optional, wild hop ale. And wow, it was tasty. It was tasty. It's on tap right now at the brew pub, and when asked if it would get them through the ski season, the amount they brewed, they had this to say.
I mean, clothing optional is going to be wildly popular. So will it get us through the ski season?
No, I don't see it as getting us through the end of the month, actually.
Oh, really?
Because people are really enjoying it.
I was thinking the weekend.
The week.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. Clothing optional. Okay, let's go taste it.
All right. Sounds good.
And taste it, we did. We didn't taste a lot of it. It was, you know, before noon. It was wonderful.
It was delicious.
Yeah, I couldn't tell the difference. Wild
sort of
hops gathered from Old Town versus your, you know, traditionally commercially grown hops. Couldn't tell.
I'm an API, an IPA person, so I like a real hoppy beer. But this was a medium bodied sort of a wheat beer. It was very good.
Yeah, excellent. Well, also wanted to mention that next Thursday, the 23rd of October at the Wasatch Brew Pub from 6 to 9 is a little party to kind of introduce the clothing optional beer. And you better go before it runs out. They'd like you to RSVP to Helena at wesaveland.org. That's Summit Lands Conservancy. You can, of course, go online and find it there.
Now, Lynn, you can also go to the brew pub or go to Squatters here locally. I think you can order the beer, can't you?
I'm not sure about that. I know they have it, you know, on tap. So Okay. Delicious stuff. Grassy. A little, it wasn't
citrus.
Floral, citrus. Yeah, wonderful stuff. We'll be right back. It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
I'm John Wells.
I'm Peggy Ijams.
Join us Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix.
Larry Warren is going to take us hiking before the snow falls, learn how to stay fit with Faye, and check out an incredible horse exhibit and Indian artifacts at the Natural History Museum.
That's Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Park and Squatters and Wasatch Brew Pub.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host Lynn Ware Peak, our first guest Dan Goldman from Georgia Institute of Technology, who will talk to us about what snakes can teach robots about movement. Robots have a little trouble navigating on sand dunes, and the desert-dwelling sidewinder rattlesnake, well, it doesn't have any trouble. It's pretty good at it. So once again, there's a lot to learn from the natural world. Dan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the program. Tell us about your background, how you got involved in robotics.
Yeah, so my background, my PhD is in physics, actually. I studied the physics of granular materials, things like sand, and how they go from solids to fluids and the other direction. But as a kid, I was interested in animals, lizards and snakes. And so when I was looking for postdoctoral training, training one gets after a PhD if one wants to become a faculty member, I happened upon a researcher and a biologist named Bob Full at UC Berkeley, who was studying the biomechanics of organisms moving on complex terrain. And when I went out there for the postdoc, we realized that there was this beautiful intersection of my PhD work and my interest in organisms, and that is animals moving on and within terrain like sand. So that's the sort of short story. And since I've been at Georgia Tech since 2007 as a faculty member in the School of Physics, I've been essentially combining these interests. How I got into robots is, in fact, as a modeling approach, turns out that people and biologists are beginning to collaborate with engineers to use robots as physical models of organisms, models that are not mathematical models, because often we don't have the mathematical equations of the environment, for example, to describe such interactions, but are actually real-world models which function perfectly well as models, which we can vary parameters and test things that are inconvenient to test in biological experiments. So that's my story.
Well, Dan, with the exploration of planets on the horizon, I think it's important that our robots be able to navigate on sand. So tell us exactly what you put together and how you modeled the behavior of the snake.
Yeah, well, so the actual robot experiments, in my group at Georgia Tech, we do many kinds of physical modeling experiments. We call it, in fact, robophysics, to distinguish it from what's done in robotics labs. The robotics that was done in this project, the Sidewinding on Sandy Slopes project, was actually done through my collaborator and colleague, Professor Howie Chosen at Carnegie Mellon University, who is a world expert on building limbless robots, multi-module robots that could be controlled in sort of interesting ways to climb trees, to move over rubble. And he had been interested to use his robots and continues to be in search and rescue applications as well as archaeological applications. Go to sandy caves and look for artifacts, and found that one of the gates he had chosen for the robot, the sidewinding gate, while pretty effective over hard ground and sort of bumpy terrain, was pretty ineffective in the robot in climbing sandy slopes.
So, Dan, I'm wondering, if you view a sidewinder snake, you see that it goes both sideways and forward, I think, but
yeah,
mostly sideways, right? So,
right.
What is it about the robot arm that needed to mirror what the sidewinding snake would do? Why couldn't it just go up a sandy slope? What did the sidewinder snake, show that it could do that the robot
yeah.
needed to do, and why?
Well, it's interesting. When we first started the project, we it was a purely biological project. My colleague David Hu and I and his student Hamid Marvi at Georgia Tech hooked up essentially with Zoo Atlanta, a man named Joe Mendelson, who's the chief curator for pathology at Zoo Atlanta. And we were just interested in exactly what you say, how these sidewinding snakes can move across not only hard ground where they'd been studied to some extent, but up sandy inclines, where as far as we could tell, there hadn't been a single quantitative detailed study of how they move really in these environments, which are really what they're experiencing in their lives. And so it started off as a purely scientific inquiry into an interesting biological problem. And only after we started looking at the robot and its failure modes did we realize sort of how to think about how the robot was failing and how to better think about what actually sidewinding is. Because sidewinding is, if one tries to describe it, as sort of successive peeling and lifting of segments of the body that propagate downward from the head to the tail. And yet the animal goes to the side of where you think it would be going, in the direction opposite to where you think it'd be going, then that becomes a very complicated way to describe it.
Yeah, it kind of defies physics, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's just complicated. And, part of the things I like to do as a physicist is sort of look for simple principles which govern potentially complicated situations. And here we're pretty sure we found one, such that the robot works in its sidewinding by essentially sending two waves down its body, one wave in the horizontal plane overlooking the back of the animal, and another wave 90 degrees to that in the vertical plane, which is responsible for lifting of segments. And if those waves are phased just right, pi over 2 out of phase, then you generate a straight-line sidewinding. And what we found was that that's not a bad model for what the animal looks like, the kinematics of the animal. What the animal's motor control system is doing is another matter, but that model even makes predictions for that. But what we could do then with that description in the robot was to actually do a strategy we saw in the animals, which is to basically modulate that vertical wave to increase the amplitude of that vertical wave to increase the length amount of contact of the body on the granular substrate.
Mm.
And we observed that in the animals that seemed was correlated with increasing incline of the sand dune. And then when we tried that strategy in the robot, it seemed to produce allow the robot to move effectively up the slope.
Well, that's fascinating. I'll just mention quickly, a couple months ago, we had someone on the show, a couple of guys on the show, who were building drones, and the drone kept crashing, and they couldn't get the thing up afterwards. And they were in a bar one day lamenting over this problem, and a fly flew into a window pane, bounced off, got up, and started flying away again, and they started modeling after flying insects, and they straightened out all their problems. So it's the natural world has so much to teach us.
Well, that's true. And, you know, we, again, the interesting, I think one of the interesting aspects to this study was that we weren't really going into this study looking to improve the robot. Professor Choset was interested in making his robots move over better. And we were really interested in kind of the principles of living systems, the physics of living systems, if you will. And it just so happens that in some situations, if you manage to uncover some of those principles, you can, and you create a reasonable physical model, you can learn enough to actually instantiate those principles into a real device that's going to go into the real world and not a kind of controlled setting.
Well, Dan Goldman from Georgia Institute of Technology, thank you so much for sharing your research with us, and thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. Thanks, Dan.
We shall return after these messages.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP phone systems and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Our next guest is Ruth DeFries, who has written the book The Big Ratchet: How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Our planet is home to 7 billion people, and they're hungry. Fortunately, there are many technologies and innovations that bring food to many of our tables. Our next guest tells us what is good about all of this and what may not be. Ruth DeFries, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Well,
it's nice to have you here. I guess my first question would be about the environmental movement. Are environmentalists going to be happy with how you present, you know, hope instead of doomsday material in your book?
Well, the environmental movement has brought us a lot of very positive changes in the world with air pollution, water pollution, lots of issues. I think we're at a point now where we need to think about solutions to our problems rather than continuing to focus on the problems themselves. We need to understand the problems and we need to have the solutions. So I see this book and this work as a continuation of all of those principles that the environmental movement stands for, which is to give us a healthier, safer, and cleaner world.
Yeah. So your premise really is that we have crises all the time, but we always seem to find some way to innovate or to create technology or whatever it is that gets us out of the crisis.
If we look back through human history, we see a long series of problems that we create and problems that we solve. So when we domesticated agriculture, for example, we created a lot of problems. Diets changed, soils became infertile. And then we also, in the wake, created solutions like recycling nutrients, fertilizer, different kinds of solutions. So our history really is one of a cycle of problems and solutions that create new problems, that create new solutions.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by your book, Ruth, and the one thing I'd ask you to talk to us about is how the potato was introduced to Europe and the United Kingdom, and which led to the potato famine in Ireland. That was just fascinating.
Yes, that's a very interesting story. So the potato came to Europe from the New World, with following the Columbus entry into the New World, and it came through to Spain in the 1500s. Originally, people were petrified of the potato. They thought it spread leprosy because it's bumpy and it resembles a leprosy patient. Eventually, the potato spread through Europe. It has a lot of good attributes like growing in poor soil and being storable and high yield and so on. And the spread of the potato through Europe was responsible for some of the growth in the population to be able to feed more people on less land. In Ireland, there was, in the 1800s, the peasants were almost solely reliant on the potato for their diets, which led to problems because potatoes are genetic clones of each other. So during the very tragic potato famine, that solution, which was able to boost population growth in Europe, led to the problem of the Irish potato famine. A fungus came in and was able to wipe out the potato crop because the potatoes are genetic clones and didn't have the diversity that would have resisted that that fungus. So a million people died, another million emigrated. It was a tragic event. And there we need the solution for Irish society to move on, to change their economy, to emigrate. So that's an example of that cycle of creating problems and solutions and problems.
So the potato does not require a seed. It's root borne, and it can replicate itself, and that's how the potatoes take off, and that's also how they get the fungus, and they can all die. A couple of other points that you made that were interesting on that topic. One was that in towns where the potato was present, the nutrients from the potato made people at least a half an inch taller than in non-potato towns. So potatoes were really good for growing the size of people. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the work of some historians who looked back through the records and were able to identify that those towns, as you said, where people relied on the potato were taller than those towns where they didn't, all else being equal, of course.
Yeah, and the final thing I'll bring up is that the devastation, I don't think people really understand how the impact that the potato famine had on the country of Ireland. As you state in your book, when the potato famine hit, there were 8 million people in Ireland. They've not recovered. There's still about 8 million people in Ireland, aren't there?
Right, yes. The population has not recovered. The economy has moved on, diversified, and people don't plant potatoes so close together anymore and use different varieties.
So, Ruth, let's take the metaphor of the potato, solving a problem, creating a problem, and then creating the opportunity to grow out of the problem. And let's apply that to something that we can all relate to, which is genetic modification and pesticides started off solving a problem. Then where has it gone? And how do you think we're going to come out of it?
So genetic modification goes back 10, 12,000 years when people started to domesticate plants and animals by selecting plants with the desirable traits like big edible seeds and being able to harvest at the same time, and selecting those and planting those seeds, in essence playing the hand of natural selection. So we've been manipulating genetics for a very, very long time. It does lead to problems like the potato famine, where we have where there were the genetic clones, and in the 20th century there were big advances with manipulating genetics through creating hybrids. Hybrid corn was responsible for an enormous boost in corn yields in this country, in the Midwest, the Corn Belt, breeding plants that could grow better with fertilizer without falling over. So many, many genetic manipulations along the way. In the current day, we have a new twist on the way that we've always manipulated genetics, and that's at the molecular level, which is quite a debate today about whether that creates problems does it solve more problems than it creates? And there's quite a debate about that.
That's right. And with pesticides as well, I mean, we're poisoning ourselves with pesticides, however they started off as a solution to a problem.
Yes, that's the story of DDT, which is so interesting, because DDT was hailed as a miracle. In World War II, it was used to control malaria outbreaks and typhus outbreaks, and it was seen seen as just a real solution to pests. Then after World War II, DDT was used for agriculture and controlling many other pests, and it did seem like the miracle. And it wasn't too long until the problems that created came to the fore, one being the toxic effect on wildlife and people, another being that the pests can have their own genetics themselves and can then become resistant. So there's always a race between pesticides and the ability of the pest to withstand those pesticides. So since the DDT problems of DDT with the toxicity, there have been many other pesticides which don't have those harmful effects of DDT, like not dissolving in water and building up in fats and so on. But DDT is controlling pests is a problem that will always be with us, because the pests are trying to take advantage of the food that we're growing, just like we're trying to take advantage of it.
Ruth, there is a documentary that's getting a tremendous amount of buzz, and it was premiered here in, not premiered, but they had a screening of it here in Park City several weeks ago. It's called Cowspiracy, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but one of the things that they talk about is in regarding the subject of conservation of water and water use, that a single quarter-pound hamburger, it takes somewhere between 700 and 900 gallons of water to produce that, when you think about the land that needs to grow the corn or the, you know, whatever the grazing product is, and then the maintenance of the cows and things like that. What do you think about the red meat industry as it relates to our resources in this world?
Well, just by the very fact of thermodynamics, about how we lose so much energy each time we go one trophic level up the food chain, eating red meat in particular is a very inefficient way to get nutrition. And it's really only possible because we can apply so much energy, generally fossil fuel energy, to producing all of that feed for animals, as opposed to eating the plants directly and getting our nutrients directly from plants. So I think, I mean, the science certainly holds up that eating higher up in the trophic chain is an inefficient way to get our nutrition, and it speaks to our abundance of energy and water and all of these resources that we now take advantage of.
Yeah, so interesting. You know, and I wanted to just ask you finally, Ruth, with our food supply in general, I mean, we have problems on either end of the spectrum. One is some people in developing countries are starving, while in our country, really, the biggest health crisis is obesity, too much food. Talk about how we're going to work out of that crisis, because it's a crisis on either end of the spectrum.
Absolutely. So the abundance of food that we've created in the last 50 years has having now a very lopsided outcome, and that's the problems that fall out of those solutions following the same pattern. So on one hand, we have 800 million people or so who are chronically hungry, are not able to take advantage of this abundance. There's enough food in the world, if it were distributed evenly to everyone, which of course it is not, to have more than enough calories. So on one hand, we have 800 million people who are chronically hungry, not getting access to that abundance. On the other hand, we have over a billion people who are overweight and obese and seeing the problems that this abundance creates. It's not just in the U.S. or the Europe or the industrialized world where we're seeing this epidemic of overweight and obesity. It's throughout the developing world, and that's occurring at lower and lower levels of income than we saw historically in the industrialized world. So, as I discuss in the book, that's one of the major problems that falls out of this abundance that we've created, the inequitable distribution and the overabundance leading to obesity and
that's
epidemic.
Right. It's so fascinating, the history, everything you present in the book in terms of crisis and how to come out of it. It's The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. And Ruth DeFries, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, John and Lynn.
Bye. Again, Ruth DeFries, The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Very interesting book. It seems like a lot of books that have been written that identify the problems, but hers is kind of the evolution of that. It's going one step beyond and suggesting that we will find a way. I know.
I thought it was fair and balanced and also very interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's cool. Science Radio will be right back after these words.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our next guest this morning is Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. October 29th is a 2-year anniversary of Sandy, and we are still digging out. The storm was unprecedented, and it caught us flat-footed. Our next guest has written a comprehensive book on those 9 historical days. Catherine, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I thought I knew a lot about the hurricane, but your book goes behind the scenes and looks at individuals. It looks at models of prediction and forecasting. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of detail in your book. It's a fascinating read.
Well, I appreciate it.
Two things that I didn't know, and just a quick one, that 11 billion gallons of sewage flowed into the floodwaters engulfing New York and New Jersey during the flooding. I mean, that's a tremendous amount, obviously. And the second one that I would ask you to comment on is the fallibility of our weather forecasting system, in that experts can use up to 45 models for one storm, but the same model that makes a perfect prediction for one storm can be inaccurate for another. Can you talk about that?
Sure, and this was what was really shocking for me in my research, was coming to terms with what we know and maybe more importantly what we don't know where weather forecasting is concerned. And as you said, the meteorologists at the National Hurricane Center and at NOAA regularly employ a wide variety of models. And what's so frustrating for them is that one model may be spot on for one hurricane, and then the next hurricane it may be hundreds or even thousands of miles off course. So they're constantly having to rely on a very human element to make guesses about what model seems to be the most reliable. And that becomes even more difficult when they're dealing with things like predicting hurricane intensity, which, as they told me over and over again, we're still just not very good at.
Hmm. So interesting. You know, we have a little friend we've spoken to a couple of times at NASA, Dahlia Kirschbaum, and she works with the Global Precipitation Measurement, the GPM. I don't know if this is new technology, but from the way, you know, it kind of dissects a storm and can take photographs from right inside of it, and it's telling them a lot more about all what's going on in all the storms. I don't know if that technology was around there, but I don't think it was in 2012. It's fairly new. So was it, in your opinion, was it technology that we, even though 40-some models, was it technology that we didn't have?
That's right, and it's shocking, really. You know, there's been a series of budgetary decisions that have been made on Capitol Hill that have really left NOAA hemmed in what I think are some really dangerous ways. You've probably seen in the news talk about the weather satellite crisis and the fact that we may not have polar orbiting satellites for up to 2 years or possibly even longer. The scatterometer, which is a wind detecting device that we use, NOAA's version of it broke several years ago, so they're relying on other countries for that information. And, you know, these are some of the most talented meteorologists in the world, but they're really limited by the technology that they can afford to buy.
Of course, Sandy was a little tricky. Sometimes it even displayed signs of a tornado, and it weaved and it bobbed and it moved in untraditional ways. This was a unique storm, wasn't it?
It was, and it broke all of the rules. And I think that's a really important lesson for us is, you know, even seasoned meteorologists thought they knew what Sandy was going to do. But a series of sort of freak occurrences with the Gulf Stream, with some other fronts and lows that were off the coast, let Sandy do what everybody thought was the impossible, and that is run headlong into the most populous part of our country.
So interesting. You know, one of the things that's great about your book is it reads like a thriller or a, you know, a suspense novel, but it's all fact. And as John said, you go into different personal stories. But talk a little bit about New York City Mayor Bloomberg at that time and how, you know, he first, you know, he was under alert and he was alarmed, but not so much.
Right. There's this very sort of beguiling moment and as the storm unfolds where it's about 36 hours before the storm is going to make landfall. And Mayor Bloomberg has this press conference where he tells all of New York City that the storm is really no big deal and that he's not going to call for evacuations because he doesn't think it'll be nearly as bad as Irene the year before. And meanwhile, governors surrounding him, Connecticut, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, are all calling for mandatory evacuations. And it was that press conference that really put everything into overdrive, both at the National Hurricane Center and even with private agencies like the Weather Channel, where all of a sudden people started backpedaling and thought, wait a minute, the mayor of our biggest city got something really wrong, and he's telling people they're going to be okay when, in fact, their lives are going to most likely be in danger. And for me, that was the most chilling moment in the book.
Right. And so what ends up happening? I mean, you know, it was only 2 years ago, and I do remember people trying to leave the city. But had he had the correct information, what would have happened that didn't?
Well, when I spoke to an Army Corps of Engineers representative who deals with evacuations and emergency management, he said that for a city like New York, and really any city of size, that city needs about 3 days to really get its people out. And as general citizens, we need about 3 days to really start to internalize threat and understand that when someone says evacuate, they mean it. And so had New York had that time, I think a lot more people might have been able to go. I mean, as it was right now, public and mass transportation shut down 8 hours after the evacuation was ordered. Transportation for people with disabilities was shut down 6 hours. And so some of the most vulnerable citizens in New York were also some of the people least likely to be able to get out of the city.
And Catherine, I have a question that I just don't understand this. You get this guy, James Franklin, from the National Hurricane Center, and then the director, Rick Nabb, and they are, you know, wringing their hands and they're wrestling with, do we call it a hurricane? Do we call it a tropical? Or that wasn't it. It was
an ex-tropical system.
An ex-tropical system. And they're really trying to, you know, what are we doing and that sort of thing. What's the big deal? If in doubt, why don't they just keep calling it a hurricane? Why don't they err on the conservative side rather than, you know, trying to get it right? Especially if the storm has tricked them so many times in the last 24 hours.
And there was a lot of pressure from people both within the industry and also emergency managers to do just that, to keep calling it a hurricane. But there were several problems here. The first was they literally did not know if their software packages would let them do that. And so they could have been in a situation where they went to issue a warning, they hit send, and the computer crashed. You know, this sounds ludicrous to us, but it was a real concern. The other question is, you know, NOAA and the National Hurricane Center in particular goes out of its way to maintain transparency and to be a trusted governmental agency. And, you know, there's this great moment in the book where one of the figures says, look, what you're asking me to do is perpetrate fraud against the American public by calling it something other than it is, and I'm not willing to stake my reputation on doing that.
So give us those definitions. What is a superstorm? What makes it a superstorm?
Well, that's sort of a word that hasn't quite been defined scientifically yet. But in the case of Sandy, what really made it super was the fact that it became a hybrid storm very quickly. And this is a very rare occurrence. It began as a very traditional hurricane with very sort of typical hurricane characteristics. But then it collided with this giant nor'easter that had been sweeping across the United States. And very often that means that the nor'easter, which comes with cold air, high pressure, is going to basically kill a hurricane. But in this case, they became something out of a horror movie where these two monsters collided and became one hybrid.
We seem to do things a little differently in this country. In Canada and Japan, they tie the national weather forecasting system to a single national news outlet. But in the United States, we don't have that type of relationship. They sort of issue their advisories, and it's up to state and local agencies and the media locally to share it with the public. What are the positives and the negatives of that type of system?
Well, I think you're right that there are both positives and negatives. We have some really wonderful private weather organizations that are capable of doing fantastic things. I just spent the morning at the Weather Channel and was blown away by the technology and the resources they have. We have things like AccuWeather. We have, you know, private forecasters who are able to take NOAA information, translate it, and really make it effective for a constituency. But we also then means that we don't have a clear information stream. And in the case of Sandy, what we saw is emergency managers had been drilling, hospitals had been drilling, assuming that they'd be getting data from the National Hurricane Center. As soon as the storm transitioned, the National Hurricane Center made the decision to hand off responsibility to local National Weather Service offices. And that changed everything. The data was coming in new forms, it was coming from new people, and there were some trust issues too. All of a sudden, if I'm used to talking to one meteorologist, and now a brand new meteorologist is showing up and telling me to evacuate the city, I really have to evaluate that.
That's right. Our guest is Catherine Miles. She's the author of the book Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. And wondering, Catherine, you started off by writing, I think it was an article in Outside Magazine that was really compelling. And then now you've written a whole book about this, but you're a science writer, but here you are, the authority on those 9 days inside, or, well, I'll call you an authority. What is the impetus here for writing the book in terms of, you know, from a writer perspective?
Sure. Well, I've always been fascinated with the weather, as I'm sure many of your listeners are as well. And what really interested me in this particular story was the way it brought together people who would never be brought together otherwise. And you mentioned the Outside article. That was about the sinking of the Bounty, this tall ship in the storm. And it brought these tall ship sailors, the Coast Guard, and the hurricane hunters together in the same place in the same life-threatening situation. And how they chose to deal with their risk and how the American public responded to those decisions was fascinating. And as I started to do more research, I realized these are decisions we're all making all the time. We're constantly trying to deal with risk, especially where natural disaster and weather is concerned. Sometimes we get it right, and sometimes we get it catastrophically wrong.
Right. So what else really surprised you? Obviously, the incorrect information, the lack of information, the lack of technology. But what else is fascinating for you in this story?
You know, when evacuation orders were issued for Katrina, 80% of the people who were given evacuation orders chose to leave New Orleans. And that number was almost perfectly inverted in the case of New York and New Jersey. And over 70% of people in those evacuation areas chose to stay. They thought they could beat Mother Nature. And, you know, there's a hubris that we all have in those situations. And I think that this was a really compelling reminder that we're never going to win against Mother Nature.
Over 100 million miles of shoreline severely eroded. I mean, this was 65,000 boats destroyed in New York alone. 7,000 trees fell in New York City parks. Weren't there three nuclear power plants that were closed?
Temporarily, yes, and some that are still showing the effects. And Amtrak just issued a new report saying that it's going to be another 2 years before its tunnels are repaired. So we're really now, just 2 years after the storm, starting to unpack the damage and the devastation and come to terms with how long it's going to take the entire nation to recover.
Not a good time for hubris.
A good time.
I mean, we were severely tested, and with global warming and the prospects of the seas rising and everything else, I'm not sure at what point the government will be able to continue to help out.
Well, I think that's where, you know, as taxpayers and more importantly as voters, it's really our responsibility to tell our leaders that we insist on this, that weather is completely related to national security, it's related to our personal safety, and if we don't insist on the technology that's needed, none of us are safe.
Well, we should absolutely insist on it, but also we need to question rebuilding and floodplains and things like that.
And that's been a really controversial subject. It's been interesting to follow up and down the coast what communities are choosing deliberately not to rebuild and what communities are. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, with climate change, ocean levels are going to continue to rise, and storm surge, which consistently kills more people than wind, is going to become an increasingly large problem for people who have never had to deal with it before.
That's right. Even here in Utah, you know, all summer we've had these deluges, just flooding and all kinds of really tremendous rainstorms. And of course, we would think we're immune to, we've had a tornado here as well a while ago. But, you know, how have you tracked the occurrence of storms, or have you, since 2012? And what are you seeing the trend as being?
I think the trend is that nobody knows what the trend is. I mean, if you look at the weather today, for instance, you know, Hawaii is at risk of a hurricane, and it would be the first time ever that a hurricane has made direct landfall, and there's only one other time that a hurricane has sort of glanced that state. You know, we see the tornadoes in North Carolina this week. I think there was a tornado in Washington State this week as well. Our weather is undeniably changing, and until we start to reach some kind of moderation where we can start to really assess what's happening, I think we all just need to recognize that we're at risk.
Lynn brought up the Global Positioning Management Satellite, which went up after, actually it's only been up for about 7 months now, I think, or 8 months. So it was before Sandy, and that of course is for trying to predict and take a, you know, do these CAT scans of pieces of hurricanes. But on the storm surge side, there's also some technology. Before you go, could you quickly tell us what new systems are out there to better predict storm surge, and as you say, is the real killer in these storms?
Right, right. And what various different organizations are trying to do, most notably the federal organizations, are really trying to come up with a way to map storm surge. Because what happens is the numbers don't necessarily mean anything to folks. When I was talking to Jamie Rome, the storm surge expert at the National Hurricane Center, you know, he'd say to a New York City Office of Emergency Management official, he'd say, look, you know, 8 to 11 feet. And they'd say, well, what does that mean? You know, is it going to come up to my knee? Is it going to go this many blocks? We don't understand what you're telling us. And so it's really a matter of trying to convey the science to officials and to the general public. The state of Virginia just issued some brand new storm surge mapping as well, using some really sophisticated GIS modeling. So it's this situation where we need to translate. We need to take the science right and make it accessible to the general public.
Superstorm, 9 days inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine Miles, fascinating book. Thanks so much for being with us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, I was delighted to join you. Thank you.
Thanks, okay, Catherine.
Thank you. We shall return after these messages.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio today. I want to thank all of our guests, and we had a lot of them today. Ruth DeFries, who's written The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Also, Dan Goldman from the Georgia Institute of Technology, and on his robot moving like a sidewinding snake. Also, Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. And then also, Justin Kingsford, right here in Park City, the brewmaster at the Wasatch Brew Pub with his Wild Hop beer.
And we also want to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. And of course, Beth Franken, our producer extraordinaire.
That's right. And as always, you can go to kpcw.org and the shows tab to listen to archived shows that you've missed. They're all there. You just scroll down on that homepage there. And it's a good thing to do when you are on a road trip, for example.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Well, Lynn, fascinating show.
Yeah, absolutely. The Superstorm book is really fascinating. It's so exciting the way it reads and the way you feel like you're inside something that didn't really happen, like a fictional
account. Oh, that
account.
Chapter it was really good. On the Bounty, the boat, and the captain went right into the eye of that storm and all hell broke loose.
That's right. Thanks for tuning in today.